Special hello to you. Hello, hello, hello. It's Friday. We made it through the week, and I'm so glad. I hope everybody is fine. You know, you do realize that Mercury is in retrograde. Boy, have you felt that this week? I have felt it the whole week. I've had several meetings about, you know, the book that I have coming out, the Marilyn, Joe, and Me, and I swear, everything that you say gets undone. It's the most weird thing I have ever had to experience in my life. But anyway, we're going to get through this. I absolutely promise you we will make it through this no matter what. It only goes till the end of the month from what I understand, so I guess we can survive that long. Anyway, but we've got a great show for you. These are things that are going to make you feel better, I promise you. You know, we don't have a whole lot of heroes in our life. You know, with everything exploding in the Middle East, it's like the whole world is going crazy. You don't know exactly what's going to happen next. We are going to talk about a heroine who really did not get a whole lot of credit during World War II, and it was in China. And this is a fascinating story, and if nothing else, it gives a, how can I say it, a kind of a momentum to the idea that we all can contribute. We all can do something, something that will make a major difference in people's lives, if you just set your mind to it. So that's what we're going to be talking about today with Kevin Kent a little later on the show. If you remember, we also talked with Arthur Silver about Sammy Davis Jr., who was, you know, like an entertainer's entertainer. And by the way, I don't know if you heard yet, Red Buttons passed away. And that's kind of, there aren't many of that comedian era left anymore. I think Sid Caesar is still alive, just barely, and I found that out from Deborah Hill. But that's about it. Red Buttons is now gone. And so a whole era of comedians and actors and people who really had a lot of, you know, what I call ethics and integrity in life are kind of gone, and there aren't, like I said, many, many heroes and heroines left. But we'll talk a little bit more about Sammy Davis and Arthur Silver, because Silver really knew this man. He was like he was a blood brother with him and traveled with him and knew him for many, many years. So he knows the real Sammy Davis, not the one that we hear about in all the publicity. But first, before we do that, you know, it is amazing when we talk about what happens to a person in their life if you get dumped. I mean, it is tragic. I have talked to people who said they've lost a spouse or a significant loved one, and it's better than when you get dumped, and especially when you get dumped late in life. We're going to talk about that and see how we can overcome from some inspiring stories. And again, it comes from people who are inspiring in all their work, and then maybe some tools on how to survive. And this can be not only for relationships, but in anything in life, and how to survive, and how to make it okay to go on.
I love the purple clothes you wear, and the way the sunlight plays upon her head.
You know, it would be terrible. You're jilted, you're ditched, you're rejected, you're dumped. You know, all very nasty, painful words. But what if it happens to you when you're in your 60s? I mean, that would be even more tragic, I would think, don't you? Well, 60 plus, especially, and if you're a woman after a long-term relationship. It must be a litany of emotions that a person goes through, from anger and mourning to revenge, and then what? Well, that's the reason we have Nan Bauer Maglin with us. She tackles the issue in her book called Cut Loose. Hi, nice to have you with us, Nan.
Hi, Mary Jane.
It's a pleasure. You know, we need this kind of thing because we talk about young relationships, and you should see the tons of books that I get from top-notch authors, you know, all talking about, well, in your 20s and in your 30s. But nobody talks about what happens to a person after they're in their 60s and been in a relationship for 40 years.
Yeah, well, that's why I did the book. You know, it happened to me. And I was in right around 60, and I'd been with my second husband around 23 years or so.
Mm-hmm.
And so he said to me that he was unhappy in the marriage, and he found a young woman, like, very young, in her 20s. And we tried to work it out for a little while, and then he left. And I was shocked. I think the word is, you know, a lot of the women writing in the book, and there's 27 of them, and most of them are 60 and above, use the word sudden and shock. And what I did is I needed something to read. You know, that's what I do when I'm unhappy. I try to find something to tell me what to do, and
mm-hmm.
and I want to hear people's stories. I want to know what happened to them.
Sure.
And I looked around, and of course, there's millions of books about women and men who break up when they're younger, but nothing about people in their 50s and their 60s, and so I decided, well, I just have to do a book. That's all there is to it.
You know, I'm so glad you did, and I'll tell you, you're absolutely right. And is it not true, and I've talked to a lot of people about this, that it probably, you know, it's not a good thing, but it's almost better if a spouse dies than if they leave you, because your self-esteem goes right down the toilet.
Absolutely. There's one piece in the book by a woman who's a widow, an older woman, and she compares her experience with friends of hers who have been dumped. And, you know, I mean, loss is loss, right? And
for
it's
sure.
Terrible, you know. And actually, women who are dumped or cut loose and women who lose their partners because of death go through that same stages of mourning. But women who are whose husbands die, first of all, economically, they don't suffer in the way that if you're dumped, you
sure.
suffer. That's the one thing. And second, you often lose friends when a couple splits up. Because, you know, some people take sides, and also they say, what's wrong with the woman? Maybe she did something wrong, you know,
yeah.
And so they blame you. And I think that a widow has to decide that it's final. They know it's final.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas when a man walks out, you often say, well, maybe he'll come back, and so you can't get over it. You're always waiting.
Yeah.
So I think, you know, even though loss is loss, I think being dumped is emotionally much worse than having an older person in your life die.
Well, especially when you, like you said, it's sudden. You don't expect it.
Right.
If you're blindsided, is what's happening.
Right. And a number of these women, and most of the book is just their stories in great detail, very moving detail. I've read them so many times, but I still cry. But a number of these women say that it was so sudden. And in fact, like they had just moved to a new house, or the man had just you know, declared his love and given her a gift. And it wasn't as if they had been spending, you know, the last 4 years fighting. And so it is shocking.
Well, and especially if it's, like you said, somebody in their 20s. I always say they dump you for 230s, you know.
Wait, say that again. It's hard to hear you a little bit. So.
Yeah, it's almost like they dumped you for 230s, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And that's sad. I mean, you go, what did I do wrong? And you start blaming yourself.
Yes. And I think, you know, a number of women, and this is another reason why I wanted everyone to write their stories, some people are ashamed and feel like a failure and feel terribly guilty, and they don't tell people. A friend of mine named Ella, for 2 years, she didn't tell her coworkers, and she kept it a secret. And I gave her this book, because it's just out, and she said it was like, you know, having a friend to talk to. It felt soothing and comforting, and she felt now brave enough to actually share it with other people.
Well, you start to believe that maybe you're the only one it happens to.
Right. And in fact, that's not true at all. In fact, statistics show us that what is called gray divorce, which means divorce in your 50s through your 80s, that gray divorce is the only area of divorce that's increasing.
Really?
So it is happening more and more to older people.
I wonder why. I mean, is it just because we're living longer, so these kinds of things are going to happen?
I think that's I think age has a lot to do with it. You know, and there are a number of therapists in the book writing and an anthropologist, and they try to look at why. And I really can't speak for men. And I'm going to generalize, and, you know, I understand generalizations don't, you know, aren't true for everybody. But I think men have a much harder time with aging. Of course, women are discriminated against on how they look, and most women feel very self-conscious at a certain point about aging physically. But I think men have a harder time emotionally accepting aging, and especially the aging of their sexuality. If they can't perform, they feel very bad. And sometimes they blame it on the woman.
Mm-hmm.
And we know Viagra has helped all this. But Viagra has also helped men be able to go to younger women now that they can perform. And I think everything shows us that men in their 60s and 70s commit more suicide than women. Women, an anthropologist in the book wrote about how women have postmenopausal zest. Somehow they come into their own when they're older. They get very involved with their grandchildren, often with their job. They embrace their aging at a certain point, whereas men, I think, have a harder time, and therefore they look outside for somebody.
I mean, I absolutely adore, there are several women that I know that started brand new careers in their 60s, well into their 60s, and they're doing phenomenally at 70 and 80. I mean, they keep going and going and going. Whereas you said, a man kind of puts everything on, and I hate to say this, but sexually. You know, if they can sexually perform, they feel like they're on top of the world. Well, excuse me, the whole world is not only sex.
Also, I think, you know, that when you get to be around 60, you have to face that maybe that's your last promotion, your last house you're going to buy, and you sort of hit a sort of ceiling. And a lot of men, you know, look around and say, well, what can I change? What is going to happen to me that's new? And maybe it's another person who's going to happen to you new.
Yeah.
Rather than sort of stay in the relationship, you know, and buy a new car, which a lot of men do in midlife crisis.
True.
They get a new person. But I do want to say one thing about the book.
Okay.
There are 27 women writing. There are two women who are writing about relationships with another woman, and they were also dumped.
Really?
Yes, and the two women went for younger women.
Oh, for heaven's sake.
So all my generalizations about men and women, you know, don't hold exactly.
Well, it's a personal thing. Everybody is different, but the pain is still the same.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what do you do? I mean, do you give some tools? Do you give some ideas on how to survive this? Because self-esteem has got to go right down the tubes.
Well, you know, I have some advice, but, you know, certainly, you know, talking to other people, getting a women's group. What I did, one thing I did that I think was really smart is I was really depressed. You know, I think you should go into therapy. I think you any kind of pills that will help you get through this period. And it's kind of a long period. Some of the women in the book say it took them, you know, a short relationship of like 10 years took them 5 years. It really worried me. Like my relationship was, you know, in the 20-year period. How long would it take me? But what I did is I asked a friend to organize a phone tree for me. And so every Monday I knew someone was going to call me, every Tuesday. You need support. You need to turn to your friends, not keep it within you. And you need to get out that anger. And that's hard for a lot of women. There's an artist in the book who said every time she sculpted, every time she cut into the wood, she got another piece of her anger out. That's better than getting it out by doing revenge. And some women talk about stalking the men. You need to use your anger. Go exercise. I started yoga at this time.
That's good.
Yeah, and I think you need to just feel like you're alive and in the world and that people like you. But
yeah, and some women, and unfortunately, but true, will also turn to things like drugs, the Valium and all this. And that's just, it's just a synthetic. It's not real. It's still, when you come out of your stupor, the problem's still going to be there.
I think you're right. But I was against any kind of anti-anxiety drugs or antidepressive drugs. But I finally, after us having very difficult times, him coming back and leaving like three times, I just couldn't take it anymore. And I did take, you know, pills for a year. And so I don't think you should criticize yourself if you need some support just to bear it for a little while so that you can learn how to handle it.
Sure. Well, no, but I mean for a long term.
Yeah. No, I think that addictions will, you know, that's a danger when you're feeling so powerless and so low.
In your opinion, after talking to all these women, because obviously they've all had very individual experiences. But whatever happened to Till Death Do Us Part, Happily Ever After, whatever happened to that? You know, 62% of, what is it, like 52% of marriages fail.
Right, and then the second marriage, that's even higher, the percentage. Well, you know, divorce has gotten easier, and I think that some people should be divorced. You know, I'm not against divorce, because some relationships don't work. But I think that we've made it easier, and also we do live longer. And so maybe, as one of the anthropologists in the book says, you know, we're not made for monogamy. You know, that if I can find the quote, you know, that we're similar to the chimpanzee and the bonobo. We're not animals, clearly, and where culture can help us control some of our desires, but we have to look at this institution of monogamy and wonder if it really makes sense.
I think marriage is too easy. There has to be classes earlier on. Same thing with child rearing. I almost feel like, to be honest with you, we should be licensing parents to have kids before you just willy-nilly do it because you biologically can.
Mm-hmm. I think it's a good idea.
Know what you're getting yourself into before you jump in and say, oh, this is going to be bliss. You know, life is not bliss. Life is a challenge after challenge after challenge.
Right. Relationships are work. And I think that's, you know, what was shocking to a number of these women is that after all this work together, you've gotten to this point where you think you're going to retire and maybe travel, all these plans, and you've gotten the children settled, why someone would run out on that?
Yeah.
And for a flash, you know, and we all know that these young relationships aren't going to last. So it's very, you know, shocking that someone would leave something like that. But the statistics show you, and this is promising, that the 60 and 70-year-olds, and this is from an AARP study, that most of them after the divorce, after they suffer, you know, after they get over the shock and the hurt and depression, say that they like themselves and that they like having their freedom. They don't like being alone and not having someone to do something with, but they embrace it. It's really the 50-year-olds, apparently, that have much more time. The 40-year-olds are already dating, right?
Sure, sure.
But the 50-year-olds somehow are having the most difficult time with divorce, and I think it's because they're somewhere, they haven't sort of accepted that they probably won't find somebody.
You bet. You bet. Now, did you find somebody?
Well, I found my husband.
Oh, this is a good thing.
Which, only one other person in the book was reunited. And that's very hard to do. Sometimes I think about how was I able to do it, because you're so hurt and so angry. But I think we both stayed in communication during all of this, and we both realized that we did have so much between each other and that we did have plans for our future. I mean, I feel lucky, but I also think, and this is very clear in the book, and there's a number of women write about it, that finding another person isn't the only way to live a life, you know, and you have to somehow have a romance about your work, about your friends, a romance about yourself.
Now, did you find another person, or was it the same one?
I found the same one.
Really?
Yes.
How long after?
The same one. What?
How long were you separated?
About a year and a half, and now we've been back together around 2 years.
That's amazing.
And I think that, you know, I would never wish this on anybody, this late life dumping.
Yeah.
But I do think that our relationship is better, that we both learned a lot in this process. And, you know, if you can survive it without being so angry.
Now, did he go after another woman?
Yes, he moved in with another woman.
Brother. You're a nice person. I'm not sure I'd take him back.
No, most people can't. And, you know, I'm not so sure I'm a nice person either. Maybe I don't know how to express my anger well enough. But I did. I did.
And each person has to do what they think is right for them, you know?
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Now, do you have a website?
Well, you know what? I'm about to have a website.
Okay.
But you certainly can get the book Rutgers University Press website. But even though it's a university press, I don't think it's, you know, it's readable. Everybody's story is so amazing. It's not an academic book at all, so I don't think people should be scared.
Oh, good.
Also, Amazon, you can get the book on, Barnes & Noble's, and I hope everyone can get it at their local bookstore, and if not, they should ask for it.
Fantastic. Well, Nan, you know, you're an inspiration just doing what you went through, because you went through it, but then having all these other wonderful women to tell their stories. I'm sure someone can find something in each one of these women to help themselves.
I hope so. Thanks.
And I thank you so much for joining us on Pop Off.
Okay, I had a good time. Thank
and have
you.
A good life.
Okay, you too.
Bye-bye.
Okay,
now.
Bye-bye.
That's Nan Bauer Magellan, M-A-G-L-I-N. The name of the book is called Cut Loose. And really, I mean, isn't it amazing to think that so many women, after 60, you think, you know, when you're together many, many years, and a lot of women in their 60s have been together with someone 30, 40 years, you know. But these are mostly older women talking about the end of mostly long-term relationships. Now, some of them were a second marriage, like Nan had herself. But this is fascinating stuff. It really is. Again, the name of the book, Cut Loose. Remember, starting over again on Pop Off is always a possibility. And we're going to be talking a little bit more. If you remember, we had Arthur Silver on a couple of weeks ago and just got into the story of Sammy Davis Jr. and all the wonderful things that he's done. And he knew this man. That he knew this man more like a brother than he did, you know, a personality. We knew the personality on stage. We knew the personality on the big screen. He knew the man behind the personality. We're going to talk a little bit more about Sammy Davis Jr. with Arthur Silver coming up on Pop Off.
I love the colorful clothes you wear and the way the sunlight plays upon her head. I hear the sound of a gentle word.
Oh, the name Sammy Davis Jr. When you say that name, I don't know anybody who does not know the personality, the essence of this human being who was just an extraordinary, extraordinary entertainer. He was an actor. He was a singer. He was a dancer. He was a personality. He was the quintessential actor's actor. I mean, there's no two ways about it. And when you say that name, as I said, I don't know anybody who doesn't know who this person is. But, you know, the man who knows him even better is the man that I've got on right now, Arthur Silver Jr. He was Sammy's blood brother, and more than that, since he was 17 years old. Can you believe that? 17 years old, he knew Sammy Davis Jr. from that time on. He was he traveled with him as a production person, as a business associate. Well, the book itself tells the real stories behind the Sammy Davis that we did not know, the icon behind the personality. In the book called Sammy Davis Jr., Me and My Shadow. Arthur, nice to have you back with us on Pop Off.
Thank you, Mary Jo. Nice to be back.
And, you know, I really want to pick up a little bit about where we talked about, you know, when you went to England. Give us some of the stories that when you travel with Sammy to England.
Okay. Well, it all actually really started, you know, it's kind of an issue. That's a good question. It's, before we left for England, Sammy was invited to do the, well, he was going over to play at nightclub, the man that brought him over. However, the first performance he was to do, he was invited to do a Royal Command performance for the Queen of England. Before he ever did anything, now you got to take a little guy, you know, born in Harlem and whatever, had never been out, never been out of the United States. It's a pretty scary thing, but the point I'm trying to bring out actually is that Frank Sinatra and about every friend Sammy had told him, don't go. The reason being that the British press is known to just rip you to pieces. And we had a press conference, and I have recreated that press conference almost word for word in the book, which I won't get into now because it's fairly lengthy. And Sammy hit them head on, and they absolutely fell in love with him. and he is a god in England.
How could they not? I mean, this man was an absolute incredible personality.
That's true, but he, you see, when they asked him things like, and they ask you straight questions. It's, you know, like, why do you wear so much pomade or grease in your hair? And his answer was simply, because I use that when I do my impersonations, I can manipulate my hair around and it'll stay where I put it. They asked him, why do you wear those? Because, you know, Sammy wore very tight clothes and very straight pants with no cuffs. And he wore these boots, and the guy asked him, why do you wear those boots? He says, because they look well with my slacks. And secondly, these are called Congress gaiters, and Abe Lincoln used to wear them.
Nice.
So that's the kind of answers. You know, he just bang, 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 all the way down the line. There's a whole series of questions. And the only one that asked the most rotten question of all, of course, was an American journalist.
Well, of course. And, you know, I loved Sammy Davis Jr. for that. He never dodged anything. He really faced it straight forward, didn't he?
Yeah, and that's what the whole book is really about, is how he faced the doors and the prejudices that came, you know, that came along with being black in those year span that we cover in the book, and him breaking through those doors and pushing them down. And that's why. Because his tenacity and because of his will to just be like anybody else. To use his words, just to be equal like everybody else. That's an expression well worn by now, but it's back in the very early 50s. I'm talking about 1950, 51, 52. That was an unheard of thing at that time for a black man to speak out like that.
Now, you say when you went to England, then they just kind of opened their arms up to him after that. What about when he saw the Princess of Monaco?
Same thing. A little bit of that story. Sammy's done did three Royal Command performances, and one was Queen Mother, and then was for Princess Grace, her Red Cross Gala, which is a Royal Command performance, too. And we were invited to do that while we were setting up to do a big performance where Sammy was over there on this particular trip to do, to tour England. We were in London for like 4 weeks, and then we toured England. At any rate, we were invited to the palace for lunch. And here's a group for you. Princess Grace, Prince of Monaco, Tony Franciosa and his wife, some big prince or something from Greece, and an old lady who was very royal from some other country, and that was it. And I spent the afternoon sitting talking to the prince about his little boat he just bought from the United States down, and it was bubbling down in the sea below us. And we were just, and I'll tell you, Princess Grace, oh boy, she's something else. She's another kind of lady. You want to talk about beauty. Oh, and David Niven and his wife.
So in other words, you guys spent time with royalty, but I bet Sammy Davis Jr. could hold his own with them.
Oh, yeah, but these were regular people. You got to separate kind of, you know, Princess Grace and her husband from you know, the Queen of England and that, because it's a different kind of royalty. You know,
yeah.
These are kind of like, I hate to use the phrase, regular people. But I mean, you could hold a conversation with them. You didn't. Everything wasn't, you know, laid out royalty. You didn't have to bend, bow, and all that other stuff that goes along with it, you know.
Right, right. You know, I have to ask you now. Sammy Davis spent a lot of time in Vegas, and it wasn't only with Dean Martin and all that and the Rat Pack. I mean, he was on his own. He was just a major, major entertainer. Did he ever have any ties with the mob?
Anybody who performed in nightclubs during that period of time, we're talking about a 20, 30-year span of time, had to have some connection with the mob, and I'll tell you why. Every club in this country now, and that has gone by the wayside, was a nightclub, and every nightclub or nightclubs was run and controlled by the mobs in their individual cities. That's why, you know, you watch Godfather and, you know, this one runs Chicago, this one runs New York, this one runs Miami, this one runs Philadelphia. So in that sense, the sense is, yes, he did. So did Frank. So did everybody else. The only thing you have to be careful with, and using Sammy's words, is don't become indebted to them. Because then that's when they, you know, that's when they have control of you. And unfortunately, Sammy was in little trouble with the IRS way back, not the one he died with, but way back when he borrowed, I think it was $5,000 from Giancana, that's the Chicago mob. And ever since then, underneath, they controlled his life to the extent that they took money from him, which he never even knew about, and everybody else got wealthy, and, you know, he didn't even know what was happening. And that's also covered in a book, because it's an involved story and an interesting one to let people know just how the mob, I use the word skim, would skim money from Sammy's income, because Sammy didn't care much about money when he was making it. When he didn't have it, he cared a lot about it, but when he made it, money meant nothing to him.
You know, I honestly feel, Arthur, that happened to so many stars, and maybe still is. They don't realize they're there, they're working, they're hard, they're on the stage, they're on the screen. They don't have time, and they trust people. You know, they've got their managers, et cetera, the money people, and those people are not doing them well.
They're very, very bad. It's the smart ones that end up with the money. They make, and now with today's salaries in the motion picture or in sports or whatever, you know, diminishes Sammy's salary, which was tremendously high.
Mm.
But he didn't pay money. He hired people that he thought, or he had people around him that he thought were watching out after his interest. It's the same thing. If you came to me, I am, quote, management, and you say, I want Sammy Davis to play in my theater next week. And I ask you what the price, or you ask me what the price is, and I tell you $50,000. And then I go back to Sammy, and we accept that. And then I go back to Sammy and say, Sammy, you're playing Sacramento this week for $40,000. Uh-oh, there's $10,000. Sammy didn't know about the
$10,000. No.
And that's the way they work it.
That is so sad, you know, that the people that, because he was a true entertainer. I mean, I can't even find anyone today that would even come close to what he was.
You sure can't, because you, in your wonderful introduction of this segment, you know, you left out nothing. He was one of the best impersonators we ever had. That's how he started singing.
That's true. Yes.
He was a young dancer, never sung a note in his life. He just danced. That's what he did. And then when he got into the impersonations, he did like three or four people. He did Edward G. Robinson, Jimmy Stewart, and James Cagney. That was it. And much against Will Masson, his uncle, doesn't he? He said, you can't be out there doing that. Those are white people. And so on and so forth. And then he started doing Billy Eckstein. And that's where Sammy started developing a voice. And from all of that, Billy Eckstein and Herb Jeffries,
mm-hmm.
Sammy became a singer primarily at the end of his career. He wasn't noted for the impersonations. Everybody knew he could dance and act, but the singing, his voice, came from starting out doing impersonations of three men who did nothing but talk.
And, you know, funny, because singing-wise, and this is why I say he was the entertainer's entertainer, he did not have a fabulous voice, but he could tell a story.
Mm-hmm.
That was what it was. It's sort of like Frank Sinatra, too. It's not a fabulous voice, but boy, could they tell a story. They mesmerized the audience.
That's just it. Sammy never claimed to have Frank. The only person that Sammy could not impersonate was Frank Sinatra's voice.
He never could
nail it. That's a true story. He tried. Sammy would throw the coat over his shoulder and put on the hat and walk off the stage and try. He would give it a look. What Sammy did was, when he did some of these impersonations, when he did them, he took on the persona of the person, which helped a lot overcome what might be a voice that's not exactly accurate. You see that person, you know, and that's where Sammy was so clever.
What is, in your opinion, and I know you've got tons of them, but what's your fondest memory of Sammy Davis Jr.?
Personally or professionally?
Personally. Professionally, you know, we know a lot of that.
Best friend I ever had.
Really?
That's the simplest answer I can give you. Sammy and I were that close, I forget the exact phrase, that man has no friend other than his brother or something to that effect. I know I just boiled that all up. But it was true. I was the one person in Sammy's life during that period of time that he would open up to. He would open the door to me. He would cry to me. If he had a problem, he would tell me in tears running down his face. He would never do that in front of Frank, Dean, or any of the rest of those people. He just, that's where he shut the door.
Well,
but to
I
me,
mean,
he
for heaven's
open
sake,
up
of, of course he would. You even you saved him from suicide twice.
Yeah, well, really once I pulled a, he almost made it the first time by himself. By driving a car off a cliff, but the undercarriage of the car got hung up on the berm. He couldn't go to it. He had to call me to come get him, but the second time I pulled the gun out of his hand and jumped on top of him.
Now, I asked you for the fondest memory. What was the most tragic part of Sammy's life?
Well, that's a forked question. On happiness, this is a general answer. I can be more specific. A
okay.
General answer of not being able to accomplish what he had tried to accomplish all his life. He made many accomplishments. He became a huge star. He became everything, but still the part of not being equal to do what he wanted to do when he wanted to do it. That's the thing that drove Sammy Davis. That's the thing that killed Sammy Davis. When Sammy got cancer of the throat, he had two options: live without a voice box or die of cancer. He chose to die of cancer. He chose his own death. A lot of people don't know that. He said, "If I can't sing and I can't perform, I don't want to live." So he had the cancer and he died from it. If he'd taken out his voice box, he would have lived. Nowadays, with all the mechanical things they have for your voice, he could have at least spoken, but he couldn't sing. He couldn't get out there. He was embarrassed to try it and all of that, and he just chose to die. And that's the truth, and that's not in the book.
That's amazing.
That's what I call an aside story. That's a true story.
Huh.
And so, that's the kind of guts he had.
A person should be in charge of their own life, and if he didn't want to go on, I mean, his whole life was on stage. I can't imagine him ever not doing that.
Neither did anybody that knew Sammy would not know that. And you know, it was a tragic thing to have all the money that you needed to buy whatever you wanted to buy, and you know, or get all of the things, the diamonds and the jewelry and this and that, but never overcame the one thing that he or most any human being wants to be, and that's to be equal. And we're still fighting that war. You know, the black and the white. They don't think that the war is over in the South. It is not.
No.
And or any place else for that matter. It may not be the same kind, but it's not the same. It's very bad. And unless you've faced it and seen it or lived it, people don't know what it's like. You take the I'm going to get political, but if you take all these gangbangers that we have now and put them in another country, put them over in Iraq right now, or Iran, or any place else where the war's going on, they would kiss the dirt to get back into this country.
Oh, yeah. Oh, no doubt.
And, you know, and when you have it all and still don't have what you really want, he never really had the true love of his life. He had it, but he lost it twice.
Tell him who the true love was.
Well, his true love was really my Brett, his wife. But Sammy was never, because of what you said a few minutes ago about Sammy, he lived to entertain. That was his life. Nothing else above that. Not his children, not his wife. He just loved, and Sammy was never cut out to be a father, even though he was a father and then adopted two others besides. He just wasn't cut out, so he was always constantly on the road. Well, like any wife, my couldn't. She's raising three black kids.
Yeah.
He's a white Swedish woman, you know, but those kids never wanted for anything financially, ever, and never will. And my certainly never wanted for anything, but she just couldn't take it. That was the one true woman in his life that was, I have the greatest, next to my wife, I think my Brett was the classiest woman I've ever known in my life.
How's the family? How did the family react to the book, your book?
With my or?
My and the kids.
Well, the kids I could care less because two of them sold dope and the other wrote a trash book about her father.
Really?
Yeah. That book didn't go anywhere. And the two kids, especially Mark, which was the oldest boy, he turned out to be a drug supplier.
And
the younger one dabbled in it, too. One of them used to go around in his Volkswagen and sell drugs. The other one, Mark, had a Rolls Royce and converted it into a drugmobile.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, wonderful, isn't it? Oh, it's really one. These are the stories. These stories are not in my book because I'm not here to slam anybody.
No.
I'm here to tell the true story of what this young man, well, what this man went through, was young when we met, went through in his life. And, to sit up and to have the parties and all the awards that he'd won and all the accolades.
Yeah.
Thank you. He had laid upon him. He still was not a happy man. And he was only happy in the years that we spent together, because we spent his childhood together. He never had a childhood. At 2 years old, he was on the stage.
Yeah.
He never knew what it was. That's why the guns and the swords and the horses and the hoopla all was. We were out having fun.
Yeah,
kids
you were
fun.
Kids.
10-year-old fun.
Yeah.
But here's a 30-year-old man at that point in time, or a late 20-year-old man. This is what we did. Of course, I grew up having that. He didn't. So that's why we got along so well together, because I would play with him I was his playmate.
Amazing.
Playmates are best. Nowadays, you got to be very careful what you say.
Yeah, I know. We know what you're talking about.
stupid phraseology nowadays, but it just hurt me. When I left Sammy, I physically went into his room and quit my job. We never quit the friendship, but I certainly quit the job because I could not take what started to happen around him. And as all he would say to me was, his answer was to me, "Well, man, this guy's stealing from you. He's taking your movies and running them in the rooms of the hotel employees." At that time, they were X-rated movies that Sammy used to carry some on the road with him. And he would charge the employees to come in, charge the employees to come in and see the movie.
Oh, that's sick.
And yeah, really sick. By the way, I really had quite a going. I threw that guy out of a theater once at Radio City Music Hall, by the way. That part is in the book, the last part. At any rate, and I said to him, "Sam, can't you see what's going on around you? I can't stand this anymore. I can't stand to see," because I was away for a couple of years. And I was fired from my job with Sammy by the mob.
Wow.
That's in the book. And I came back. And when I came back, all this was around him. And I said, and he would just say to me, "Oh, man, it's only money."
Oh,
that
sad.
Was his exact phrase to me. I said, "Maybe money to you, man, but I'm not used to hanging around this kind of stuff, watching people steal from you like they do."
I want to let him know, you do have a website, right?
Yes, I do.
Let him have it.
My website?
Yep.
Arthur's. Well, I'll tell you what, you can get it. Here's the easy way to get to it. Sammy'sbook.com.
And no apostrophe, just Sammy's, S-A-M-M-Y-S, book.com.
.com will take you to one place, and from there you've got the website. You go to a dozen places.
And the book is available every place, right?
Well, it's not every place. As a matter of fact, it's kind of funny what's happening right now. I just started about 2 months ago writing another book. I'm going to answer your question. The best place would be to go right now. I would go to Amazon.com because you can get the book about $4 or $5 cheaper than you could in the store.
Okay.
Otherwise, I would start out with any one of the major bookstores. If they don't have it, they certainly can get it.
Fantastic.
But Amazon is the best one, because I know I get so many requests for that. But from that book, and you've seen the book, so you know what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
The pictures that are in that book have created such a stir that I am now doing. I have it sitting in front of me now. I just came back in town with one of my editors. I am doing a coffee table book.
Fabulous.
Which will have at least, well, I came back with 411 pictures to start with, and I still have another 1,000 to go through. Pictures taken by Sammy and me, or people of us, which would be very, because I have been asked about the pictures.
Well, I'm looking forward to that, and we're going to have you back again, and we got to keep touch. That's all there is to it.
Mary Jane, you can call me anytime you want. I like to be on your show, and, if you have any more, we can get into side stories, they're really the guts of the man.
You bet, and that's what we're going to do. We're going to keep doing that, because people need to hear that.
Yes, by the way, we've got my fingers crossed. We got a TV show. show in the works. It's been in the works for 2 years. Disney ABC has it now. They've had it for 6 months, but other people are looking for it. Cause I'm trying to because the script has already been written for a 4-part miniseries.
I will keep touch with you, and we will be confabbing on a regular basis.
Thank you very much, Mary Jane, and nice talking to you again.
Take care, Arthur. Have a great weekend.
Well, it's very hot where I am right now.
Oh, yeah, same here. Okay, take care.
Okay, darling.
Bye-bye now, Arthur.
Bye.
That's Arthur Silber. It's S-I-L-B-E-R, Jr., the name of the book, Sammy Davis, Jr., Me and My Shadow. And, you know, this man goes back to, like you said, the mob days, the Sammy Davis, Jr., the people that really were part of Vegas and part of that whole era of who the stars were, which, you know, they don't exist anymore. But I wonder if some of that shenanigans still does go on. Well, the real stories on Pop Off, that's what it's all about. Talking about a real story. Coming up, we don't hear a lot about heroes. At World War II, we know there were terrible things that went on, the Holocaust, etc. But did you ever hear of a place called Nanking and a lady by the name of Mimi Boutron? Well, you will on Pop Off. And this just is an extraordinary story that you've got to hear about. You know, some great heroes never get their due when other situations occur. Now, you say, that sounds kind of strange. What do you mean by that? Well, there is an interesting concept behind what happens with people when some major occurrence kind of takes over everything. Take World War II, for instance. We recall the suffering of the Holocaust, and truly, it was terrible to the max. But many folks, myself included, remain in the dark about the Japanese invasion of China. It was overshadowed. Now, Kevin Kent has brought it to light in a book called Nanking. And Mimi Boutron, one of the greatest American female heroines of the last century, is who he talks about. Now, but who knows her name? Honestly, I never heard of her. Well, Kevin, I might add, is the second son of a World War II English RAF pilot with a family tree that goes back like almost 1,000 years. And Kevin is also a screenwriter and composer. Kevin, nice to have you with us on Pop Off.
Good afternoon. Thank you very much.
Now, please tell them about Mimi Boutron. When I read about her, I went, how come we don't know about her? She was a heroine to the max.
She was an unbelievable character. And the more I look into her, I couldn't believe her self-deprecating manner. But even more so, that she was, you know, to describe her, she was a 5-foot-tall, you know, rather plain Jane, who had been in China for almost 20 years at the time the Japanese invaded China.
She was a missionary, right?
She was a missionary. She went there to help start a girls' college, which is for teenage girls at that point, in Nanking, which we now call Nanjing. And she was absolutely fascinating to me as a hero, and to the end, she never considered herself a hero. But, you know, you compare her to a Schindler, or you compare her to any of the fantastic heroes we heard about who stood up in the face of adversity, and she saved 10,000 innocent girls from being raped and murdered.
How did that come about?
Well, you know, in a world where China's in the news every day, it's still surprising to me that as Americans we know so little about, you know, their history overall. But the precursor to this was Shanghai had been invaded, and the Japanese Tanaka plan was well underway, which was the colonization of China and the enslavement of China and the acquisition of its natural resources. And they were sweeping down, and for the first time in Shanghai, they received a strong challenge from the Chinese nationalists. Now, I got to remember, China at this point was kind of split apart. You had the nationalists fighting the communists, and you had the Japanese fighting both, but primarily the nationalists. And it was a mess. And what happened was that because of the challenge to the Japanese army in Shanghai, the Japanese were mad as can be. They thought they were just going to sweep through it, and Nanking was to be the example of what would happen if they continued to resist. And this was to put it into perspective as well. Nanking was the Paris of China. It was a brand new city, the capital of China at the time. Big wide streets, you know, beautiful ponds and lakes everywhere, a cultural center. It was the crown jewel of the Chinese nationalist government at that point.
So in order to, by taking them down, they made a major devastation in China, is what you're saying.
Not only that, the actual plan of attack was to demoralize all of China so that China would give up and they could get on with their conquest of the West. And one of the other interesting, you know, historical facts that I found out in studying for this screenplay in this book is that the first aggression towards the United States occurred in 1937, where the Japanese sunk a U.S. ship called the USS Panay in broad daylight, and it had kind of the remains of the American universities and the American, people who were trying to get out of there. The last of the refugees, really, were all on this boat, and the Japanese sunk it in broad daylight.
So
and
actually, there was a U.S. attack by Japan prior to Pearl Harbor, is what you're saying.
Long before Pearl Harbor, and the thing that amazes me is, I guess much in the way I was shocked about nothing was done about the, you know, the USS Cole or whatever, the U.S. government chose to do nothing.
With China having the Olympics in 2008, we're going to have to start understanding a little bit more about the Chinese culture, which we do not understand at all.
It's fascinating, and it's somewhat dichotomous in that you have old China, you know, prior to the Cultural Revolution, which happened in the late 40s, and what we all grew up with in school as our Chinese history was, you know, be prepared to hide under the desks, you know, because the Chinese are coming.
Right.
And that mentality was really, when you think about it, was very much a protectionist mentality after the extreme suffering that they went through. Now, nobody's going to say that the communists, I'm certainly not going to say we're a better, you know, breed for the overall cultures of the world, but in comparison to enslavement, you know, what the Japanese were encroaching, you know, upon them, that was their mission at hand. You know, you kind of get a different feel for what the Chinese, you know, they are the people that that built us the big wall. You know,
mm-hmm.
The only object to be seen built by man from space is the Chinese wall.
And to be honest with you, Kevin, even what is happening now. You know, they're supporting North Korea, and they're not wanting to have any economic untie the economics with China, and this is a, you know, major problem. They are a huge country that we have to deal with.
And I think, to be honest with you, I think it's more that they're holding their fist up to the Japanese, because remember, it was the Japanese that submitted to the UN this resolution.
Because of their fear from North Korea, of course.
Yeah, exactly. And it's the Japanese who had, you know, prior to World War II, they had a 25, 30-year culture of militarization.
Yeah.
And it's significant historically what's going on right now. And it doesn't surprise me that the Chinese are taking the position they're taking. It disappoints me, but it doesn't surprise me.
Now, do you have a website, by the way?
I have a website. It's called nankingthebook.com, N-A-N-K-I-N-G, thebook.com.
Great. And the book, I assume, is available every place, right?
The book is available on Amazon.
On Amazon, okay.
Right.
This is a story that needs for people to really hear about and know exactly what went on. It's amazing. And to see the hero that we had in Amimi Vautrin, these are the kinds of things that we need to be talking about on an open basis all over the world, not only here.
That's right, and I think the more people understand history, and, you know, history, I listened to Bob Bennett the other day talking about, he just released a book on American history, and he said something that I thought was fascinating. He said, you know, history has such an incredible rich texture and an incredible, it's fascinating on so many levels that it surprises him that more people don't absorb it. I mean, they'd rather see some, you know, read some current story,
yeah.
but they're all based upon history. I mean, we are living history right now. And what I did with the novel Nanking is I wanted to make it accessible. I wanted to make it so that it didn't read like it. You know, I mean, there's another book out called The Rape of Nanking, which was a very famous book by Iris Chang. And it's much more documentary style. My book is I created a fictitious Chinese family who was the diplomat for Chiang Kai-shek, and he had two daughters that went to the school, and one of the daughters is in love with a Japanese diplomat, and I made it a very engaging, very compelling walk through history.
So when are we going to see this on the big screen?
We're working on that right now, actually. There's meetings abrew right now up in Hollywood.
Okay, Kevin, I want to keep touch with you because I want people to know about that, okay?
Thank you very much.
And I appreciate you being with us today. You take good care and good work.
Thank you so much.
Take care, Kevin.
Good afternoon.
Bye-bye now. That's Kevin Kent. Name of the book is called Nanking. It is fascinating. And it is once you pick it up and start reading it, you can't put it down. And we will keep touch with Kevin and see if that's going to become a screen. And I can see it. I mean, just absolutely, it's going to be a keeper. Heroes don't always look the same on Pop Off, but we present them to you anyway. And I want to present to you the idea that I want you to join me back here on Monday, because we're going to have some great topics for you, as always, right here on Pop Off. And have a wonderful weekend, you know, and start thinking about doing positive things and things to move forward and look to your neighbor and help them out, too. In the meantime, live simply, laugh often, love deeply, and above all else, you dare to dream. The dream is what it's all about, and we're in the best country in the whole world to do that. But it all starts with you. Dream on. We do on Pop Off.
About things he's gone through, so it's hurting me. Now it's history. I've laid on my car. And that's what you've done too. Nothing more to say. No more ace to play. The winner takes it all. The loser standing tall.